Welcome back to the Wise Athletes Podcast with Joe Lavelle and Dr. Glenn Winkle. For episode number 65, we persuaded Dr. Brendan Egan, Associate Professor of Sport and Exercise Physiology and Deputy Head of School in the School of Health and Human Performance at Dublin City University, Ireland, to join us to explain his research findings on the importance of muscle for aging health and his recommendations on how we, older athletes, can build up and retain a solid base of muscle to power our athletic endeavors and our headroom for a long, healthy life. I have recently begun to worry about sarcopenia, you know, that loss of strength that characterizes aging late into life. Well, I see it everywhere. I asked Dr. Egan to help me understand this problem better, to target my efforts, and I think you'll find our talk very interesting. All right, let's talk to Dr. Egan. Dr. Brendan Egan, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Yes, welcome. Great to have you as well.
Brendan, can I call you Brendan?
You can do, yeah.
Thank you. I am really quite tickled to have you on. I've been, for a long time, thought the term sarcopenia was something that applied to other people. And in fact, I can even remember thinking that this aging thing was something that applied to other people. Mm. And I thought of what an advantage it was going to be for me as I aged up in my competitive age groups, and all those old guys who I raced against started dropping off, right? You know, and I'd be killing them because I was not aging.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Turns out I am. And so I also am, since this revelation, been concerned that this sarcopenia thing might apply to me too. I've seen it happen to my own parents. And I know that you are an expert in this area, although your expertise goes well beyond that. And before we dive into that, Glenn, do you have anything you wanted to add as to what you're hoping to learn from Brendan here today?
Oh, gosh. Hey, he's the expert. So, like you said, the key thing, though, is that I think all of us recognize, I guess, well, not, I shouldn't say that, but I think that many people, as we get older, we start to recognize that, oh, my gosh, I am aging. And oftentimes what I discover among my clients is that they go, I didn't expect this to happen the way it did. Even though they were told by their elders, people in the older categories, that this is going to happen to you too. They go, oh, no. We all think we're immune. So this is going to be great. I'm looking forward to it. I really am. That's why I'm up at 5 a.m.
Fantastic. So, Brendan, you're joining us from Ireland. I appreciate that. And I wonder if maybe before we dive into the list of questions that we've chatted about here before we hit record, you could give us just a bit on your background.
Yeah, sure thing. I think you've touched on some really interesting themes already in terms of what we're going to talk about. So I'm looking forward to it. I was trained as an exercise scientist as an undergrad, and my area of interest really then became nutrition and metabolism. So I pursued a master's in sports nutrition, and as a result, I've actually practiced as a with athletes since around about 2005 or thereabouts. As an applied practitioner, but academically, my research interests took me into the areas of things like molecular biology and the mechanisms by which muscle adapts to exercise. That's what my PhD was actually in. But since I finished my PhD and then established my own research group, our work has tried to encompass really what we call translational research, which is from cells, understanding what's going on at the cellular level, all the way up to what's happening in the real world. What interventions work or don't work in a range of populations, from pregnant women to older athletes to younger athletes, and everything in between. So hopefully I've got some answers to some of these questions that you're interested in.
Well, that sounds really good. I'm tickled to have you on, and I guess if I could, maybe I'll ask you to help me summarize maybe what we can talk about, and maybe even what is the nexus of all of the different things that you have become expert in. I think that you might call it performance over the lifespan or something like that. How would you say it?
Yeah, well, it's actually, you're using my the phrases I like to use here. So nexus is a good word. We often talk about muscle, skeletal muscle, being at the nexus of performance across the life course. That's the title of one of my talks, in fact. And the reason, I mean, in research, a lot of people are in academia, a lot of people have their own favorite organ of interest, and mine just happens to be muscle. And the reason for that, of course, maybe the way I can convince you that's important is that we know that muscle is a major function in terms of locomotion, or ability to move, but it's also got lots of metabolic functions in terms of it's where we dispose of a lot of the sugar and fats and so on that we eat within our diet. It's a reservoir for the protein that's within our in our bodies as well. And it declines in terms of both its size and its function over the course of our lives. And therefore, you know, having an interest in how we develop that in early life and how we improve performance of muscle, you know, as athletes, for example, in younger life, and then trying to maintain that size and function, you know, in the face of inevitable declines. And I think what you and I might discuss is really around what is the rate of that decline and what can be done to slow it and so on and so forth. You know, all of these things are why we put, you know, we talk about a muscle at the nexus of health span. So yeah, let's take it.
Okay. Well, that's great. This is particularly troubling to me. You know, the audience will know that I have said many times that, you know, when I was in high school, my goal was to be a bodybuilder. I wanted to be Arnold Schwarzenegger, number two. And so muscle has sort of been at the center of my physical universe. I always wanted bigger muscles. and I had some success at having bigger muscles. But the prospect of shrinking is very troubling to me, you know, if not just from a physical performance and maybe mental performance, but just ego. So I really hate this idea. And so I'm curious to learn from you here a little bit about why this happens. Mm-hmm. And then what are some things that we can do? And then we'll just kind of follow our noses along that. Can we start with this? Why is this happening to us?
Yeah, well, the life course perspective, if you look at it, is the model that's often used is that we lay down or we build muscle and strength. And I'd probably call that function or functional capacity in a number of cases throughout this this chat we have. But we improve, you know, as we train. And well, naturally, as you imagine, going from, you know, child up to teens and into your 20s, there is just natural development that we have as human beings. But of course, many of us try to accentuate that those gains by the types of training we do. And some of it is strength-based and some of it is endurance-based. Some people do a mix. But no matter what happens, it seems that if you look at many different lines of evidence, it seems that somewhere around the age of 40, we've tend to have reached our peak, again, in different domains of fitness. And after that, there's inevitably going to be some decline. And as I said already, a lot of cases for people who are very inactive, that decline is rather steep. For those of us who can maintain activity throughout our older years, the decline is less steep. And that's the initial promising message is that, you know, being active in some shape or form is going to be beneficial in terms of offsetting those declines. And why it happens, I think, is an open question in the sense that, you know, there's many different theories of aging, and you know, a lot of these are based on a cellular level and mechanistic level. How they directly impact muscle is somewhat of a mystery. I mean, in terms of the people who do no activity whatsoever, you know, we're fairly sure that it's inactivity per se that causes the loss of muscle, the kind of use it or lose it phenomenon. But for those of us who are active and who are, you know, training pretty well and are still trying to do as best we can and push ourselves hard, it's not obviously to, you know, in the research domain as to what actually results in those declines. The best we can say is that it's possible to slow or offset those declines by maintaining activity, by maintaining other good lifestyle habits. And I think what you and I might get to discussing is, you know, what are the types of activities, endurance-based, strength-based, how much of each, you know, and those types of things are probably some of the more interesting questions that are in the field at the moment.
Yeah. Wow. Well, and I wonder, I know that I've heard that you've got a little bit of a nutritional background too. Yeah. Does nutrition play a role here?
Well, if we're focusing on the kind of the response to exercise training, as you well know, there's a lot of research around the area of protein and its support of initially in terms of muscle growth. If we're talking about younger athletes and younger individuals, in the older populations, again, a huge amount of interest in, say, protein intake as a general domain, regardless of exercise. And it's, you know, the idea that low protein intakes might predispose people to greater declines. And the flip side of that being that augmenting training responses by appropriate consumption of protein around training, or, you know, overall higher daily intake than maybe the recommended daily allowance. These are things I think that are fairly well established at this moment in time. So that's the kind of the protein story is the big story, I think, from a nutrition point of view, if we're talking about muscle size and muscle health. But, you know, you can't get away from the fundamental questions about what is a healthy diet and what are good lifestyle habits. Like, these are all part of the bigger picture, I think. But I mean, obviously, we're going to probably focus on exercise and protein later on. But again, it's a bigger picture thing than other than just these couple of niche areas.
Well, yeah. I guess the truth of the matter is that I guess two things. One is we can't cover everything about how to be healthy in an hour.
Yeah.
But the other is that being healthy in general is a prerequisite for being physically active. And so anything that is going to affect the health is going to affect your ability to be active, and your ability to be active is et cetera, et cetera. So I guess I'm not really sure how to eat this elephant. I wonder if I saw a beautiful chart, and one of the disadvantages of audio only podcast is that you can't do any visuals, but I saw this beautiful chart that you presented that had over time, and I'm not even sure what the axes were, but it showed that, you know, it probably was like strength, but let's just think of it in terms of like physical ability, capability. And it sort of rose throughout life. I mean, you started off very low when you're an infant, and it rises very quickly, and you get to, and you had said, you know, I think that in this chart, it was on, you know, like your high 20s. And you had said that maybe for non-professional athletes, maybe it's 40 that, you know, you hit your peak and then it starts to decline. But there were two charts. One was the person who was physically active, and that, and it went up higher early in life and then stayed high long. And then there was the lower bar where the person was not active early in life and was not active later in life. And the bar never went quite as high and fell off more precipitously. And one of, there was a line near the bottom, which was sort of like, when you get below this line, you're disabled. You know? And so the person who was not active at all during their life got to this disabled part much earlier than the person who had been active throughout their life. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a really nice description. So you're right. The y-axis, as it was in that particular chart, is what we call functional capacity, but it can often be used, you know, muscle strength, muscle size. These are, you see the same figure, same graph represented with slightly different y-axis. But the x-axis is time, as you say, age in years. And you describe it really well. I mean, there's a trajectory at younger age that will differ, again, depending on someone's lifestyle habits. And in particular, you know, the exercise that they do and the amount they do and the type that they do will influence how much functional capacity they develop when they're younger. And then, you know, that rate of decline, as you say, is influenced by the amount of activity. It's influenced, obviously, by what they did early in life, but then also influenced by what they do later in life. That line that you refer to, that threshold, is the disability threshold. And the idea there is, if you if the decline in muscle or in functional capacity, you know, drops below that threshold, as you might expect, you're now disabled in the sense that you've lost what we call a loss of physical independence. You know, no longer able to take care of yourself, no longer able to be mobile. So this may be, you know, struggling to get and downstairs, or in and out of bed, or up and down out of a chair. That's the level that we're talking about in terms of loss of physical independence. And, you know, a lot of people reach that. In fact, many of us will probably reach that no matter what. But the question becomes, at which point in our life, at what age does that actually happen? So another way of thinking about it is that that time period in our life, from when we first exhibit signs of, let's call it, illness, to the point that we die, is often called the, you know, period of morbidity. And one of the goals of healthy aging as a concept is to compress the time of morbidity. In other words, have a shorter period towards the end of our lives where we have these comorbidities, or where we are below that disability threshold. And
the opposite side of that same coin is that you're actually well above it right up until that point.
Exactly. That was going to be my point. So
okay.
Again, the obviously we don't have the visuals here for the podcast, but the point might be that in individual A, for example, who's got all the bad habits, maybe they're dropping below that threshold at the age of 60. On the other hand, individual B, who's got good habits in younger age, maintains them throughout life, and you know, other is otherwise healthy, maybe they drop below that threshold at the age of 85, 90, you know? Yeah. So that's the kind of difference that we're talking here. And when you see it on a graph, you're like, oh, yeah, that's a nice graph. And when you hear me say it, oh, yeah, yeah, 60 versus 90, that sounds pretty good. But when you think about it as 30 years, and you think about, you know, that's in some cases 50% of someone's life, or, you know, or one third of someone's life. I mean, it's an enormous amount of time to have such a major difference in the quality of life and in the actual life expectancy as well. And that's really, I think, the message, the benefits of good exercise habits and good lifestyle habits in general is really at the end of life. It's, you know, a lot of people in their 30s, 40s, 50s probably dismiss all these things as, you know, kind of like you said at the start, you know, it is inevitable that you're going to age, and you sometimes think that's not happening to me, but at some point it does catch up with you. You know, it does manifest, and that's what we have to try and get into people's minds, I think.
Well, that's really interesting. You know, with the audience here being active people, I think the question is less about trying to encourage people to get off the couch. Mm. And maybe we all could benefit from not sitting as much during the day and trying to get all of our exercise all in one lump, you know, every day or every other day. But in general, I think the audience here understands the benefits of exercise and this idea of wanting to stay healthy for a long time, that, you know, wise athletes. But I think that your chart with maybe the line, that threshold line at a slightly different level, could be interpreted as, so tell me what you think, as a level when you get below it, it starts to become hard to get back above it. You've gotten too far down. Mm-hmm. When your strength is so poor, or your mobility is so poor, it's hard to get it back. Mm-hmm. And so the idea then would be not as a result of just aging, but injury or illness causing you to have to stop doing what you're doing, and then you fall. And if you were so close to that line and you fall below it, now you can't get back up above it again. Yeah. And I've heard you refer to this. I can't recall the name of it. It was this, you may be able to come up with a name, but it's this idea of when you have injuries or illnesses and you have these steep declines, but then you can make it back up, but you never quite make it all the way back up. What did you call that?
That was called the catabolic crisis model. And the idea there is that, you know, it's not always a linear decline that will occur in something like functional capacity. You know, it's not like every, now don't get me wrong, there are statistics around, you know, at the age of, after the age of 40, let's say, the average loss per decade might be, you know, something like 3-8%. But when we get over the age of 60 or 65, the loss becomes 1% per year. So, you know, closer to 10% per decade. So you can kind of put those types of numbers on it in terms of average decline over time. But it probably doesn't happen for all individuals as a linear decline over time. It probably is, like you say, and, you know, an injury, for example, that this is true, in fact, of athletes who are in good health. You know, a period of inactivity caused by injury will lead to declines in muscle function. And, you know, athletes will rehab or rehabilitate out of those periods and return to that level that they were previously at. As you've suggested there, it does become harder to do that the older that we are. And that's just because our muscles do develop a resistance to the exercise stimulus and to a nutrition stimulus, which we might talk about, this so-called idea of anabolic resistance. You know, that does occur as we age. And so, as you say, the decline that will occur during a period of inactivity is greater the older that we are and the poorer health that we're in. But also the ability for us to recover or to rehabilitate out of those declines does become more challenging. So it's a kind of a vicious circle in some ways in terms of the way that a small period of decline can manifest. And that's why that idea of the catabolic crisis model is that it's kind of more of these kind of sudden drops in functional capacity that occur repeatedly for some individuals, as opposed to a steady decline.
Well, and I know that as I've gotten older, I get more injured more often, and the injuries take longer to recover from. And where it used to be that I'd have an injury sometimes and then it would disappear, now I've got, I always have something that's wrong with me. You know, it's just a matter of, is it, you know, can I go on with it, you know, or not? And, I'm never like hoping to be without some pain or yeah, well, a dysfunction.
Let me jump in and say that, you know, even though I was using the word injury there, we're probably, and in this audience, I think what people will understand by injury is what you described there. I suppose in the general sense of the of this model, it's more like we're talking about like a fall that leads to a fracture, or we're talking about a period of, you know, flu or maybe COVID is more recently that would lead to someone being bedbound for, you know, 10 days right. or 2 weeks. You know, these are the types of insults. Someone who's, you know, very physically active and endurance athlete training 5 times a week. And, you know, the next thing they maybe miss a couple of weeks training. That's not quite, you know, I'm conscious of the fact that we keep talking about decline here in this chat. And for your audience, you know, maybe they're getting a little bit worried about missing even one training session. But no, I think in people who are quite physically active, you know, missing a week or two here is not going to make a big deal. But it's really the scenario where it's complete, you know, bed rest for 2 weeks or on end, or someone who's just really not capable of doing much activity, that's where these declines are much more pronounced.
Yeah. And so what I have been thinking ever since I've been listening to your stuff and wanting to talk with you about it is this idea then of trying to build up some extra capacity that I can lose. I don't want to lose it, but I can lose it if something was to happen. If I had to have a surgery I can't tell you. I mean, joint replacements are a big deal now among people that I know. And, the surgery and the science and the medicine has gotten really good on that, but you still get shut down for a while. Yeah. And people, it takes them sometimes a couple of years before they get back to racing or doing what they used to do. And do they ever get back to where they were? Well, probably not. You know, if they were in their 50s or something when that started, or even worse if later. So this idea of building up some headroom so that you have room to fall, so that you don't fall so far that you can't get back at least most of the way. What do you think about that?
No, that's a really nice way of putting it. I suppose for your audience, maybe it's dawning on you and then that what we're talking about, or a lot of what I'm talking about, is in the context of building muscle size and muscle strength. And if for endurance athletes, that's not actually the focus of much of their training. In fact, you could probably argue that endurance athletes, while they are phenomenally cardiovascularly fit, aerobically fit, and, you know, good cardiovascular function, good metabolic health, and so on, from a strength and muscle size point of view, they're not going to be no worse. Don't get me wrong. They're not worse than the average member of the population. Right. But compared to what we're talking about in the context of, say, strength training for older adults, or the importance of muscle size for the types of scenarios you're talking about, a surgery or could be a cancer treatment, for example, there's definitely an element where if someone is doing only aerobic training, you know, for an endurance sport, then they're probably not hitting one of the key features of training that we do need across the life course, which is to be doing both strength and endurance, because you're targeting, you know, all aspects of health in that way. So I agree to your point. A headroom is a good way of thinking about it. You know, kind of build your strength and stay strong for as long as possible. You know, that will protect you to a certain extent for any of these catabolic crises that might hit.
Yeah. And then when you do have an issue and you have recovered from it and you can come back, maybe you better hit that recovery and get it back as fast as you can and not settle into a lower level of capability.
Yeah. No, that's true.
I speak to that because I'm in that right now. I had surgery at the end of January on a knee injury, and my knee was in a locked brace, immobile for 6 weeks. We're talking concentration camp leg here.
Yeah.
And so I am just now getting started to rehabilitate it, and it's like number one priority in my life right now.
No, I mean, the thing, what you described there, would you believe, is actually a model that's used in experimentally to look at what we call disuse atrophy. So the you know, you might hear in common parlance things like muscle wasting, or, you know, that kind of thing. What we're referring to in the context of, say, inactivity and muscle wasting, the technical term is disuse atrophy. And one of the models of disuse atrophy is to cast someone's leg for a period of time. And in that type of experimental model, you have one leg that remains active and may even, they may you know, do some exercise training on that leg, and then that's compared to the casted leg. And you begin to understand then more about the dynamics of, you know, inactivity versus activity on the same in the same person. It's a really nice experimental model. But of course, the
what I'm except for to, the patient.
Well, just what I'm getting to saying is that you you've been your own experiment there. So I'm sure that you may not have noticed any difference in the size of your leg, or maybe you did, but under the skin, so to speak, I'm sure that there's probably a little bit less muscle there than there had been at the start. And yeah.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh, and I tried everything. You know, I tried exercising the good leg, you know, because I'd heard that there was some bleed over effect. Yeah, yeah, I tried overeating on the protein, which just resulted in me putting on belly fat. Yeah. I mean, I tried everything I could think of, and man, when the body doesn't need that muscle, it's gone.
So that's a great point, and I'll tap into that, because the idea is that when you contract your muscle, there's electrical activity within the muscle, and that's essentially one of the really important signals to muscle, whether in terms of growth or whether it's in terms of just maintenance of muscle function. So if you imagine, like, astronauts, for example, when they're in space, or the casted example that you're giving there, when there's a lack of electrical activity, a lack of weight bearing on that particular muscle, a lack of contraction, that's where the you know, the absence of that signal is what will drive that atrophy response. So I'm not surprised to hear that not much worked. It's interesting. I think one of the things that I see a nice bit of research on recently is the idea of using neuromuscular electrical stimulation, NMES as it's sometimes called. So this is where you put electrodes on, for example, your quad muscle in the case of the injury that you had. And there's this idea that type of stimulation, although it's not, you know, it's never going to be like the, you know, you see the TV ads where people are wearing it on their belly and all of a sudden they develop a six pack. It's not going to quite be that. But it's in a few studies that have been done in this domain, they've showed that type of electrical stimulation, even the absence of your leg being able to move, that can help maintain that muscle mass. And I do think that in the future, that's probably going to be standard of care, you know, once a bit more evidence accumulates for it.
Okay, well, here's the bad news. I tried that too. and maybe it would have been worse without it.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah.
I'm telling you, it was nothing made so much of a difference that it wasn't like a horrible, demoralizing thing to look at that leg and go, oh my, a lifetime of effort in building up the muscles, gone.
Well, I don't know if you've heard me talk about this before, but one of the, you know, I gave the example of some of the percentages per year and per decade and so on. But one of the headlines from one of those bed rest studies one time was that a decade's worth of muscle was lost in 10 days, you know. So 1% per day is 1% per year, you know. So it's, I can hear your pain.
Yeah. Well, so what I have found in other times of my life, although it was always upper body, is that muscle that I used to have, I can get back much faster.
I was going to make that point. I mean, I think, of course, the younger you are, as I was saying with the young athletes, they rehabilitate very quickly. But in the case of someone like yourself who's fit and dedicated to it, I think the trajectory of your rehab could be that you return to where it was. You know, I think the example is often given, I think the chart you're talking that I refer to, where the recovery is incomplete. So the person maybe recovers enough functionally to not be in pain and to be able to get around again, but they ultimately haven't recovered enough strength or size to be back to where they were. That I think is a frequent occurrence, but I think that can be overcome in someone like yourself who's dedicated and fit, you know. So, so some optimism there, I think. Let me give you that.
Well, if I fail, it will not be through lack of effort, I assure you. Yeah. I am going to try as hard as I can try. So let's talk a little bit about what do you think people should do? I think we are mostly here talking to an audience of endurance athletes, some of whom are wisely doing a variety of things, maybe some swimming and some running and some cycling and some hiking and things like that. And maybe a smaller share are also doing a little bit of resistance work. But it's in this idea of trying to stay a robust, healthy, strong, capable, independent human being, what sort of exercise do you think is important for people to make sure to do?
Well, if we look at the broad guidelines for exercise for good health, you know, And I know this audience is already doing the aerobic side of things, but the exercise guidelines would suggest that we do two sessions of strength-promoting exercise per week. They would also suggest that we do at least one session of flexibility per week as well. And in both of those domains, I think the idea that we are working on some aspect of balance, I think, is important as well. Now, so again, that flexibility and balance, they're things that don't tend to get a lot of attention, but they're absolutely central to that overall picture of functional capacity.
Sure.
But if we talk about the strength-promoting exercise idea, or resistance training, which is what it's usually called, again, the prescription does not get too specific in the context of, say, public health guidelines. But obviously, there's a huge amount of research going on at the moment in that domain in terms of questions like, you know, what's optimal in terms of number of sessions per week, what's optimal in the number of exercises that might be done, what's optimal in sets and reps schemes. You know, these are the types of questions that there's been an enormous amount of research within the last 10, 15 years in particular in older adults. So I think it's hard, like a lot of people who would say, for example, if their passion is endurance sports, they might be coming to this idea of, well, what's the minimum I can do to derive a benefit? And I think it's probably not the ideal philosophy to think about, because, okay, if they're highly motivated in terms of performance, maybe it can be spun to them that, you know, you're doing four sessions a week already of your aerobic training, endurance training, and you want to add in an extra training session to make it five. Well, actually, you're better off making that extra session a strength training session for your overall health. And they might go, yeah, but I'm still hoping to compete. I'm still hoping to win some races. I think the only way to tell, and this is not me spinning it, this is the truth, is that there's good evidence now that strength training in endurance athletes, including masters endurance athletes, does benefit endurance performance. And
so you can have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah. Now, of course, as you and I were talking just before we started recording, you know, this is called concurrent training, this idea that you're doing both strength and endurance-based training. And you know, since the 1980s, there's kind of been a negative spin on concurrent training, the idea that if you're doing both forms of training, that they interfere with one another, that's the so-called interference effect.
Right.
But again, there's a lot of nuance to the interpretation of that literature. And again, most good coaches are able to now program in a way that can optimize, again, now we're talking about performance here, for both the development of endurance performance, but also that strength component that will also benefit, running or cycling performance. So overall message is what I'm getting to saying is that whether it's from purely from a performance point of view, or whether it's more of, you know, longevity and health in later life, I think it's hard to get away from the idea that there needs to be at least one, if not two, strength sessions done per week if we're looking to optimize in those domains.
Yeah, that sounds good. I think that I have always thought, or long thought, I should say, that this interference effect is more related to the person who is at one of the extremes. You know, they're an extreme endurance athlete,
or they're an extreme
bodybuilding type person, and they're, you know, and they're looking for fractions of a percent.
Yeah.
And so this interference effect is a thing. But for a regular person who's even if they're trying to be better at endurance or better at strength, being a healthier person is going to be more important than a little bit more at that extreme exercise program. Anyway, just thought I'd get that off.
No, I fully agree. That's a great way of summarizing it.
So when we talk about resistance, I've had some people on as guests who are experts in resistance training and even for cycling, resistance training. And there's always a lot of talk about, you know, lifting heavy, getting under big squat bars and, you know, deadlifting and things. Mm. And it gets modulated down a bit to, you know, try for the older athlete to, don't get injured.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to blow something out and now you've wrecked yourself forever. But I'm wondering if we're talking about our health, then how important is lifting your body, multiples of your body weight versus just having good mobility of your body weight, you know, like you're talking about balance, and being able to move your body in multiple dimensions. So are you thinking in terms of lifting weights or
using bands or just like moving your body on the ground?
Yeah, great question. So if we talk about, first of all, just some of the evidence around this, there's a large study that came out of the UK a couple of years ago now at this stage, and they actually asked that specific question, which is that if we're talking about health and, you know, basically the reduction in mortality risk, is there any difference between doing gym-based activities versus doing lifting under weights, let's say, versus doing your own body weight? And essentially they found that the risk reduction was similar, almost identical, in fact, between the two. I often hear pushback about body weight training, and the pushback is generally, well, that's fine for a beginner. You know, they will get a stimulus out of body weight training, but at some point, you know, you will have to lift heavier weights. And I do accept that. I mean, it is true that there's probably a limit to the progressive overload, let's call it, that you can produce with body weight only training. At some point, you probably will have to bring in weighted training if you want to continue to progress from a strength point of view.
Sure.
But for individuals who are doing, for example, are coming from no training whatsoever from a strength point of view, they can derive a huge amount of benefit from a 12, 24, even a year-long program, 12 or 24 weeks, I should say, or a year-long program in bodyweight training, you know, as a starting point. And there are enough variations in terms of the types of bodyweight exercises you can do, whether it's squatting or lunging from a lower body point of view, side lunges, you know, moving in multiple planes of movement. And equally with upper body, it's quite easy to do push-type exercises. The one place where it's more challenging is if someone can't do a pull-up, for example, chin-up pull-up. I'm not sure what terminology you guys use, but then they probably do need to have those resistance bands to be able to do those types of pulling movements. But the one thing we published a paper a few years ago now, again at this stage, and we looked at bodyweight training in middle to older age adults. It was 12 weeks of training, 3 sessions, 45 minutes each per week, and we used only bodyweight exercises except for resistance bands, which are used for the pulling movements. But one of the major emphasis that we had in that study was the tempo or the timing of the reps themselves. And I know that in the public domain, this is often promoted as a super slow training, I think is probably the most obvious example of this. But it is that idea of trying to control the eccentric or the lowering component of the exercise. So in the context, say, of a squat, it is controlling that downward movement. For the squat, of course, is the example of almost like sitting into a chair. And if you control that downward movement, we were using 4 seconds of eccentric movement, a pause at the bottom, and then two seconds upwards. That's a you know, a 6-second rep, let's call it. You do 10 of those, that's a minute. That's quite different to someone who just, you know, gets up and down of a chair a few times and says, you know, I don't really feel any stimulus here. You know, that idea of controlling the so-called time under tension or the tempo, that makes a huge difference in terms of the stimulus. And I think that's probably where I think people don't appreciate with bodyweight training. That's one of the ways to overload with bodyweight training, is to use that controlled tempo.
Oh, interesting.
And just one other point I make about bodyweight training, it goes to the point you made about mobility and balance and so on, is that many of the bodyweight exercises that you do, inevitably, as you progress them, you end up working on single arms or single legs, and there's a bit of dynamic stability and balance that comes into those naturally. And that's why I think bodyweight training has a lot to speak for it. But again, like I said earlier, there comes a point at which if you really want to overload and develop strength further, then there probably is a need to actually lift some weights.
Okay, good. I'll say that I have, as I've had different guests on, and the term mobility work has come up, you know, which is sort of a combination of, you know, flexibility, stretching, and body weight type of things. Even when I was, you know, going to the gym and lifting hard and feeling like I was accomplishing my goals and building muscle mass and strength, and also riding hard and strong and being happy with my results. When I would start doing things out of the plane of action that I was used to, I was terrible. It was amazing to find really how fragile I was as a person, because I was limited in the range of motion that I was employing and the dimensions that I was engaging. So yeah, something for people to think about, as you know, because life just, you know, comes at you from all different angles. You got to be ready for it.
Look, I see that all the time. Like, I mean, I play a sport still at a pretty decent level. I play Gaelic games, which is a field-based invasion sport, not too dissimilar to soccer, except we use our hands. So I say soccer versus rugby is kind of the way our game works. But yeah, I can compete at a fairly good level, but I'm quite limited in things like being able to bend down and pick up my kids. So it's kind of like it's one of those things that I think about quite a bit as well. And in the older adult domain, one of the things that's often talked about is just that ability like that to get up and down out of a chair. But another way to think about it, because I mean that's quite limited, you're kind of at the far end of the spectrum there if you're struggling to get up and down out of a chair. But this idea of being able to be on the ground and get off the ground, I like that as a concept. And there have been some studies that have looked at so these again are these kind of epidemiological studies where they look at a bunch of people and they look at their ability to get up and down off the ground and whether they need support to be able to do that. Can they do it freely or do they need to grab onto things and lean on things and so on? And the evidence is really amazing when you look at it. It's like a dose response. You know, the better people are able to get up and down off the ground without supports, the longer they're predicted to live, or the longer the period before they develop illnesses of older age. And so I think, again, you know, what's the cause and effect there? Should we be training people to get up and down off the ground? You know, that's the argument for that. But I think the overall message I would say is that it's important to be functionally able as opposed to just very fit on a bike, for example, you know. And I think that's an important message. There's a lot of us are very motivated to perform well within our sports. And I'm not saying that's not healthy. I'm just saying that there's another domain of health that involves all of these other things that you and I've talked about now that does matter and does need to be, people need to have it in their mind.
That's really amazing. I think maybe we ought to not train learning how to get up off the ground and just rely on our strength to every now and then to see how we are doing on that and not overcome a lack of strength by skill. I think that you could argue, I say this a lot and I'm not really 100% sure it's true, but I think you could argue that falling is a leading cause of death. And as you get older and you become more unstable, you can still get around, but something will happen. My grandmother leaned on a door that she thought was closed and it wasn't. Mm. And the door opened on her while she leaned on it and she fell down and broke her hip. Mm. And she died from essentially complications from that, yep. You know, sometime later. I don't think this is an unusual story. So as we get to where we're less robust, less able to quickly adjust to changes in our balance or changes in our footing, then we fall and our bones are more brittle and we can die from that sort of thing. So keeping your strength up so that you can handle just these surprises from life is a way of extending your life.
Yeah, I fully agree. I'll put some more color to that example that you gave. And these are data out of a study that was done in Italy, but they were looking at people who fell leading to a fracture, and so a hip fracture. And it was something, you know, a small number, like 4% died acutely, you know, within a few days of their fall. But after 2 months, and the numbers might be a little bit off in terms of percentage, but it was something like 40% were dead within 2 years. But there was another 60% or so who never fully gained independence. So it was a very, very small percentage of the people who fell ultimately recovered. All the rest of them had all of these other, you know, issues that I talked about there. So it's interesting, you know, what you're describing in personal life is, you know, is a reflection of what's been seen many times within the research. So it's a good message I think you're making.
Yeah. We all should be bearing that in mind, and we want to build up this headroom and then hang on to it. And a way of thinking of that is just this ability to deal with surprises and walking around the neighborhood.
Yeah. So the current thinking, of course, on that, people might be asking, well, you keep talking about strength and, you know, so how does that translate? And the idea really is that as we age, and this is, again, kind of relevant to endurance athletes as well, is that we lose more of the so-called type 2 muscle fibers. And these are the muscle fibers that are more involved in the reaction to a trip, you know, they require sudden movements or powerful movements. And the idea is that, as many of you who are endurance athletes might know, is that you really are trying to accentuate the capacity of the type 1 fibers at the expense of type 2 when it comes to a lot of endurance sports, which again is not really the ideal scenario if you believe that one of the consequences of aging is the loss of these type 2 fibers anyway. And one of the things we're trying to do with strength training is to essentially equip or activate or, you know, certainly stress those type 2 fibers so that they're available to be used then when needed. So again, if the messaging, maybe your audience is an audience that are, you know, going to be like, well, you know, strength training is for me, and they don't need much more convincing. But hopefully we've given a couple of examples here of where people can see, well, you know, there are good reasons why strength training is important. And if that's a message people get, you know, it may change their habits, and that could be a good thing.
Well, good. So strength training is not just for improving your sprint at the finish line. Yeah. It's to save your life. We'll be running short of time here. And so the one thing that I wanted to touch on again, and maybe in some more detail, is this question of protein consumption. Okay. I think that you're going to be able to help us a lot with that. I mean, there's a lot of, I don't know about whether there's like real confusion over it, but there's a lot of themes that run through the internet related to, you know, diets. And some diets like vegan and vegetarian make it harder to get enough protein. I you know, some people are probably going to hunt me down and kill me for saying that. And let me say that I actually did try to go vegetarian for, I don't know, a few months last year. And my answer for the protein was I was going to use plant-based protein powders.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was able to do it. And I ended up quitting because I just found that I was having protein shakes all day long in order to get the amount of protein that I wanted. And I'm a high protein person. So maybe I didn't need quite so much. But I think that there's some, you know, and then if, so the people are who are looking for those kind of diets, or they're, you know, maybe for ethical reasons or you know, for whatever reasons, they're listening to people who say, oh, you don't need that much protein. You know, you look at the RDA, it's really a teeny tiny amount. But for the older athlete who, to start with, is older, and the older person has what I've called an anabolic resistance, or what I've heard called that. And so maybe you can tell us a little bit about this, the need for protein, the RDA, and why an older person, especially one who's active, and we should all be active, should get more than that RDA, and maybe how much you think we should get.
Yeah, look, I mean, this could be a long, long conversation on protein alone, but we'll try and keep it brief. So I think you've made, you know, touched on many of the important points here. The RDA is, you know, in most countries is what we could say 0.8 grams per kg. I know you guys are working in pounds there, so someone can do the math for me. But probably the important message is going to be the percentage differences here, which is that for endurance athletes, and for older adults, in fact, the recommendation is probably about 1.2 grams per kg. Which is, this is per day. So that's 50% more than the RDA on average. Yeah. And in a lot of team sport and strength and power sport athletes, we're talking as much as 2 grams per kg of body mass, which is, you know, 2.5 times the RDA. Yeah. So that's a lot more protein. And I'll talk about the whole plant versus animal in a second. Okay. But specifically to your question about, does the older endurance athlete need more protein? There's a guy, Dan Moore is his name. He's a researcher at the University of Toronto. He wrote a really nice paper. I think it came out this year, by the way. Maybe it was late last year, but it was you know, something like Masters Athletes, just older versions of their younger selves. And the point he was trying to make within that paper was that, you know, we should just treat older adults as older athletes as we do with younger athletes, which is that most of the same nutrition principles apply, you know, in terms of overall energy intake, macro intake, and so on, because these are, you know, highly active individuals. The other side, of course, is just the sedentary older adult. And again, there's probably a little bit more nuance around there, because like you say, if you're consuming lots and lots of high protein foods, especially if they're not supplements and if they're food based, that can also end up being a lot of calories. And you said earlier in the I can't remember, was this before we started recording or not, but that, you know, consuming a lot of protein when you're not doing much activity is just going to lead to a gain in fat mass. And we published a paper, actually very similar findings last year. We had an older adult group who we asked to eat more protein but not exercise, and like you describe, almost You know, you could predict how much fat they gained, and that's exactly what they did gain. So there's no panacea when it comes to protein, but there is a definite need both for older individuals and for athletes, and consequently older athletes, for, you know, something in the region of 50% to twice the RDA would kind of be the ballpark figure there.
Just to summarize, like a gram per pound of body weight, something like
that? Yeah, so a gram per pound of body weight, that would be about right. And that's 2.2 pounds in a kilogram, is that right? So you're about there, yeah.
Okay, good. So for somebody my size, that's, you know, like 190 grams a day. That's quite a lot.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we get onto the animal versus plant idea, you know, one of the reasons why there was a debate about this in the first place was the idea that plant proteins were inferior in terms of their amino acid profile, and in particular that they were absent of certain essential amino acids. Yeah. What's become apparent over the last number of years, and I mean, this field is burgeoning, there's a lot of research at this moment in time, is that if plant proteins are combined in a way that there's no deficiency in any of the essential amino acids, so, you know, because they can be complementary to each other, and in particular then if people consume enough protein in the form of plant protein, there doesn't seem to be any major deficit compared to an animal protein. Okay. However, if we're talking about real food, there are quite big differences in terms of how much protein is per 100 grams or per 100 calories or proportion, whatever way you want to measure it, because many of the protein-rich plant foods do tend to be very high in things like fiber and carbohydrate as well. So the example I often give is that, you know, the quantity of, for example, chickpeas, which would be considered a protein-rich plant food, versus the quantity of, low-fat yogurt. In terms of calories and in terms of actual gram value, you have to consume a lot more chickpeas for a lot more calories compared to yogurt if you're talking about the same amount of protein. So the point is, it can be done. And the complexity that I'm describing there really speaks to why we have experts in nutrition and dietetics who give advice to people who need it. And, the arguments that take place online about the supremacy of one form of protein over another, I think they're often done in isolation without considering someone's total diet and some of these other aspects that we've talked about, particularly around their energy needs as well, depending on the amount of training that they're doing. So, you know, much of what we're talking about on a per kg basis, you can imagine that becomes very different if you've got some very different proportion of the diet if you've got someone who's, on a 2,000 calorie diet versus someone who's an endurance athlete who needs 3,500 to 4,000 calories a day. It's a very different dietary pattern that we're talking about. I think that's.
I see. So percentages is tougher for protein. You should be thinking of it in terms of an amount of protein.
That's as we understand it for now. Because if for example you said 30% of protein of energy intake in the form of protein, that's very different for 2,000 calories versus 4,000 calories.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. That makes perfect sense.
The protein recommendations at the moment are generally done on a per kg or per pound basis rather than a percentage of calories.
Okay, well that makes sense. So the last little bit about the protein, and then we'll start to wrap it up, is this question of, you know, should you have all your protein all in one meal? Do you need to spread it out throughout the day? Sometimes people I'll hear say, oh, you should have some protein before you go to bed so that you're digesting that. And I think the idea is that your body is catabolic and anabolic at different times of the day and you from stimulus and eating protein, if you are over a certain threshold of leucine, I think is the main thing, you get a stimulus for building muscle and in between the stimulus disappears and you start breaking down muscle or proteins, I guess maybe it's more than just muscle. And so if you can get more of the stimulus, more of the day, a stimulus could be exercising and it could also be the eating of the branched-chain amino acids that you get more building and less breaking down.
Yeah. So I would, on the protein messaging, you've touched on a lot of things there to do with one is protein distribution, one is meal frequency. I mean, these are all concepts that are being researched with that, overarching theme of what stimulates muscle growth to the greatest extent or what prevents breakdown, again, if you're thinking about catabolic states. And the way I would describe it in my view of the literature at the moment is that the most important thing is probably total protein intake per day. That, like if we're talking about a hierarchy, I would say total protein intake per day. But I wouldn't say that you can eat that all in one meal. I know people, there are proponents that, that would say that, but I do think that we should have it spread throughout the day. So that's called protein distribution. Now, should that be 3 meals? Should it be 4 meals? Should it be 5 meals? I personally don't think the evidence is very strong as to, you know, that, that there's an optimal. I think the question becomes, does a person have the appetite for 3 meals, 4 meals, or 5 meals? And then how much protein would go into those meals in the context of their overall total protein intake target. So now we're kind of getting into the weeds here about, you know, on an individual basis, what would work best for certain individuals. But the reason it's challenging is actually that example you talk about, bedtime feeding. So the research at this moment in time, I would agree with your point. You know, the rationale is that you consume some protein at night before bedtime, and that may prevent so-called breakdown during the night. But one of the problems with the studies that have been done to date is that when they give protein at night, they're actually giving more protein overall per day. So it's impossible really at the moment to separate, is the effect of this pre-bedtime feeding an effect that increases protein intake overall, or is it something to do with specifically to do with nighttime? And one of the papers that we worked on and published last year was, we actually just restricted people to 3 main meals, and we just asked them to eat a lot of protein in those main meals. And you might say, well, what difference does that make? Well, it turns out that the majority of people in the Western world don't really consume adequate levels of protein at breakfast. They consume a little bit more in at lunchtime, and they consume a lot at dinner time or post training if they train in the evening. And that's called a skewed distribution. And the idea is that a more even distribution for the same amount of protein might be beneficial. But again, the evidence for that, theoretically it makes sense, but again, the evidence I would not say is particularly strong, but it's kind of a common sense practical approach as well, and there's probably no drawback to that. So again, it's as I said, there's a lot of opinion, and there's a lot of what would you say, hints in terms of what might be optimal, but I don't think we've a defined, you know, prescription yet for protein intake. But there's some broad concepts I think that most people are applying, and I think it's effective if it's done well.
Fantastic, Brendan. That's very helpful. I appreciate that. We're out of time, and so I want to give you a chance to, you know, any last little tip, and then if you could also let the audience know how they could find out more about you and maybe how to find you online.
Yeah, well, I think the one piece of advice I give to people who presently do no strength training is that it does need to be there. I think it's part of it's an essential part of good exercise habits, and you know, one of the keys to successful aging. So if it sounds daunting, some of the concepts that we've talked about, or if you know someone is very much put off by the idea of doing 2 sessions per week, I think start with one. Start with very little. Maybe it's just bodyweight exercise within your own home. Maybe you're scared. You know, we've published some research on older adults about their hesitancy to get involved in strength training, their dislike of gyms, the idea that it costs a lot for people who are retired. You know, these are all barriers that must be overcome. And so I think it's important to identify those barriers on an individual basis. And maybe it just means that, you know, you work with an individual coach and just, you know, begin to get that process going. But I do think that the strongest message I think we can give from today's talk is really recognize the benefits of strength training, even if you are an endurance athlete, and begin to incorporate that into your weekly training.
Awesome.
In terms of contacting me, I don't do the socials. So if someone wants to get in touch with me, they can email me. And my university is Dublin City University. So if you search my name in Dublin City University, you'll find my email address. And I'm always happy to reply to questions. And they often tend to be a lot about what we've talked about. So hopefully I can direct them to this recording. If they've just tuned in at the end to find out how to contact me, I'll say, well, we covered that earlier in the session.
Fantastic. Brendan, thank you again. Glenn, is there anything you wanted to throw in here?
Now, that's great stuff, because like I said, there's so many athletes that are in their ages, like their aging times, and they're seeing this decline. And then it's in for myself as well. Like Joe, this in the same way. I want to stem the decline, and obviously I make my errors in protein or in sleep or in lack of strength training, stuff like that. So this is good stuff to remind us all that we need to take care of ourselves at all levels.
Great stuff.
Fantastic. Gentlemen, have a good day. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening in to my discussion with Dr. Brendan Egan. You can find more information about Dr. Egan in the show notes, and while you're there, you can sign up to take a free Fitness as Practices assessment, send us a question to address on the podcast, see all of our episodes, subscribe to our podcast, and you can sign up for our newsletter. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and share it with your friends. That'd be a great help. Thanks again.